All right. Well, tonight's topic is interesting. When I myself saw it, I thought, did I actually agree to this? But when I started thinking about it a little bit, I mean, the idea is that what we're looking for here is that we're looking for some simple principle of right living that will actually serve us through good times and bad, that is not dependent on dogma, that won't be undermined by the latest scientific discovery, that is practical and accessible and true to our own experience. I mean, that seems like a tall order, and it would be a tall order in most circumstances. I happen to have been very fortunate to have been taught by great teachers, and therefore, in fact, the answer was quite obvious. I have to give credit where credit is due. I have friends staying in my house, and I told them what I had to talk about tonight, and I said, what is the one true thing? And they immediately told me. I might have thought of it by myself, but they gave it to me anyway. So before I break the suspense, I'm going to build up to it a little bit this way. There are vast numbers of theories about life, scientific theories, theories, religious theories, psychological theories, and everybody has the answer. Whether it's vitalized water or a liver flush or vegetarianism or breatharianism or Mormonism or Buddhism or Islam, whatever it is, everybody's got some answer for you. And yet, I mean, and some of these answers seem to fight against each other. I mean, literally these days fight against each other. You know, people are blowing each other to bits and themselves sometimes with it in order to defend what they consider to be the one sort of aspect that can't be violated. And, you know, the level of willingness to impose everybody's point of view on one another is reaching crisis proportions, literally. And yet, despite all those different points of view and those different conflicting points of view, when you look around at humanity, you basically see the same basic system going on everywhere, don't you? And if you've had the opportunity to travel and traveled in such a way that you actually meet people, and in this life that we live now in Palo Alto, Menlo Park, Mountain View, you can just go knock on your neighbor's door and you're in a completely other culture. In our community where Ananda has a residential community on the right at the edge of Mountain View in Palo Alto, and we go Christmas caroling every year. We've been doing it for more than 20 years that we've been there. And, you know, we knock on doors. We're meeting Orthodox Jews. We're meeting Hindus. We're meeting, you know, Muslims. And we're offering to sing these, you know, happy songs about Jesus. We realize we have to expand our repertoire a little bit just to be able to deal with our neighborhood. But what we find is people really look essentially the same. You know, very slight variations on the theme. People want to marry. People want to have children. People are concerned about their financial future. They need to eat. They get cold. They get lonely. They get angry. Get insecure. I mean, you just, you know, make the list. And everywhere you are, you see it. People do it in different languages, and they do it in different national costumes. And they do it around different holidays. And sometimes they do things that may even seem quite bizarre to us, but underneath, it's still just the same thing. So no matter how diverse the expressions might end up, if you keep tracing it back, you're going to find the same reality everywhere. You know, kindred spirits everywhere. It's just what it's like. So we've got to be working with fundamental truths. And those truths must not be just a matter of somebody's opinion. They have to actually spring from some real life experience that can be replicated. Now, sometimes we can learn a lot from watching children, because children do not have so many complex layers of egoic involvement in their experiences. They're just much more out in the open. Animals too, to a certain extent, but children also. And there's one characteristic that we watch about children, if you notice. When children get excited, You know, what does a child do? A child gets excited. They always go like this, don't they? Their energy is sort of up, and they get so excited that they keep leaving the ground. They can hardly stand themselves. And it's not like they sort of decide or learn this behavior somewhere. Or children get really excited. You know, they'll stand up on their toes. They'll just sort of try to get higher and higher. It's as if literally their excitement is moving them upward, isn't it so? And what do they do when things don't go their way? Well, they'll collapse. They'll throw themselves down on the ground. They'll crumple up into a little ball. You know, they'll assume the fetal position, whatever it might be, because it's as if when unhappiness strikes, you know, their physical beings actually shrink. And you don't see a child, you know, with that kind of elevated jumping up and down when they're happy. They don't think about it. They just manifest what they're going to manifest. Isn't it true? And even instinctively, if we're watching a dramatic performance or trying to do a dramatic reading of our own of one kind, the person never comes in and says, you know, today I really got the award that I was just really hoping to get. You know, it came to me today, all my whole life, everything I've been working for. I'm just so elated, I don't know what to do. You know, the director would say, you're fired. Because it would have to be, you know, it came to me today. I've been working for 10 years, the completion of everything, and I was recognized today for what I did. I just, you see, it just, you have to say it like that. Because there is something elevating, just literally, physically, and energetically, about that which pleases us. And when the person comes on like this, it's because I lost my job. You know, my mother has cancer. I really don't know what I'm going to do with myself. You know, the whole thing, doesn't it go smaller and smaller? You know, you crawl into bed, you curl up in bed, you pull the covers up, you try to just get, there's nothing moving you upward. Now, the science of yoga, which includes physical yoga postures, but it's just, the physical yoga postures are just this tiny little sliver of what the science of yoga actually is. The word yoga is a Sanskrit word. It actually means union. And it means the unification of many diverse elements in life. You know, yoga can be, you know, excuse me, ladies, the way I talk, I just can't have a different energy going on. Yeah, so I would appreciate it. Thank you. It's just too hard for me. Yeah. So I was saying the science of the union. Yoga is the science of unifying all the diverse elements of one's personality, of body, mind, and spirit. And the yoga postures are very beneficial because they do create a sense of unity about yourself. You know, they're very relaxing to the body. They harmonize the different elements of the body. And then also they harmonize, if they're done in the right way, they harmonize the mind and the body. But ultimately what the science of yoga is about, it's really dealing with the fundamental separation that the individual feels from the universe. When we speak of it in spiritual terms, we talk about the individual's unity with God, which if you're not comfortable with the word God, there's lots of other ways to say it. But what we're really talking about is we all live with this, I would call it a poignant awareness of our own limitations and separateness. And this, whether we're consciously able to articulate it or not, this longing to be integrated into something larger. When I look back on my young life, this is the book Lee pointed out that I wrote about Swami Kriyananda, and there I describe Swami Kriyananda is an American disciple, this is his picture, of an Indian guru. Yogananda, who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi, if you haven't read this, it's a classic book. This book and the millions of people who've read it is largely responsible for the spiritual renaissance of the West. I mean, that was his magnetism. You go to almost any group where people are at all moving towards spirituality, and you know, at least 80% of the people in the room have read this book. And many, many notable leaders in many fields trace back to this book. Well, Yogananda died in 1952. Kriyananda, who's now 83, was a young man of 22 in 1948. This book was published in 1946. So Kriyananda actually had years of training directly from Yogananda, which is increasingly rare because Yogananda now died 60 years ago, so there aren't a lot of people left, and those who are left are elderly, relatively speaking. Kriyananda I met when I was, as it happened, 22, and he was here in the San Francisco Bay Area lecturing at Stanford, and so that was for me now almost 40 years ago. It'll be 40 years in about a month, 1969 November. So from him, from Kriyananda, I learned this tradition of Indian teaching. As I've said to some of you who know, I was raised in a Jewish family, very, you know, secular Jews, but nonetheless, it was my sense of self. I was raised very intellectually. I actually started college at Stanford, but I dropped out of school. And, you know, I was expected to do who knows what, but not this. It's the only thing I can say. And even in my own self, I was never inclined towards spirituality. It just never crossed my mind because there was no example in my world that would tell me that that's what I was looking for. But very interestingly, as you look retrospectively back at the flow of your life, I realized that my earliest conscious awareness was of this incredible sense of confinement. And not confinement in my family or even in my life conditions were quite comfortable and very supportive. But I felt, I realized in retrospect, confined by the simple limits of my consciousness. You know, I was just this one person. I had this great desire to be very helpful to the world. I had a sense of the potential of self-expression that was within me, but I just was all by myself in this tiny little body and just trying to figure out how to relate to this universe. And my first impulse in life was that I would get married and I would have many, many children, because I thought, and I am married, but I've never had any children, because the thought in my mind was that that would make me bigger, because I felt very small. I felt very separate, so I will produce children. And then when I have lots of children, then I will feel bigger. I will have expanded. At a certain point, almost exactly when I met Swami Kriyananda, it occurred to me that even if I expanded from one to a dozen just by producing children, it wouldn't begin to touch what was really bothering me. And what was really bothering me was my desire to be unified with infinity, to be unified with all of reality, to really escape from this anguishing sense of separateness that is the normal human condition. You know, we manifest it as loneliness, we manifest it as desire for a mate or for money, but what we're really working with is deep inside ourselves. We sort of, how did I get here and what am I doing here? And that is the unifying theme that you see all over. Now, our Western culture makes it infinitely worse because there's such a tremendous emphasis in our culture on material things. I heard a late-night a psychological advice giver on the radio when I was taking a late-night trip. And someone said, "Why are Americans so insecure?" And she answered so simply. She said, "Because everywhere you turn, you're being told that unless you have whatever this is, you will never be happy. It's just a constant bombardment of something else that you need to acquire, and then when you acquire it, you will be better. Whether it's a slimmer chin, whether it's smaller hips, whether it's a particular dress, whether it's something to do with your hair, whether it's shoes, whether it's a PhD, whatever it is, we're always being told, especially in this culture, the world does it in general, but this culture does it, you know, with genius, that we're really inadequate. And so we go and we acquire all those things, but they never touch the essential isolation of our individual consciousness. And that's something else, because everything is really about your consciousness. If you're in the most beautiful place, but you're in a depressed state of mind, you will not find any happiness in that place. And if you are in an elevated state of mind, a joyous state of mind, wherever you go, that will be your experience, isn't it so? I mean, we've all had that. I mean, have you ever had any kind of ongoing relationship with somebody who's determined to be unhappy? And, you know, after a while, you can be patient for a while, but there comes a certain point where you basically just want to smother them with a pillow. Just, you know, just get with it. Yogananda put it really simply. He said, if you decide to be happy, nothing in the world can make you unhappy. If you are determined to be unhappy, nothing in the world will ever make you happy. Now, that is one true thing, but I haven't quite gotten to the final true thing. Now, we also experience that these various conditions that I'm describing are a matter of degree. You know, sometimes we find ourselves often inexplicably in a far more harmonious, uplifted state, and then sometimes seemingly inexplicably, we find ourselves in a less uplifted state, a less joyful state. Now, what we find in life, if we look very carefully underneath what's going on, that people in the world are motivated by two fundamental realities. Kriyananda has written a book called God is for Everyone, and it was based on a smaller pamphlet that Yogananda had written, which he called The Science of Religion. And basically the principle is this. Yogananda took the whole philosophy of India, which is extremely complex, and I'm not even talking about Hinduism. I'm really just talking about the science of yoga, which is the whole science of how to become unified within ourselves. Hinduism is a whole other imposition on it. And he reduced it down to two principles. The human being wants to experience happiness and wants to escape suffering. And absolutely everything that we do, however misguided, however stupidly ineffective it may end up to be, is motivated by one of those two things. We feel that this action will reduce our suffering, this action will increase our happiness. It's better actually to use the word bliss than happiness, because bliss is a state of consciousness, whereas happiness tends to be a situation. You know, I'm happy because. When we feel blissful, that's something that emanates more from inside of us. This is the limitations of the English language, and we don't want to make things confusing by using Sanskrit words. Actually, the word ananda, the translation of that is bliss. We translate it usually as joy, but bliss is also the same. But it's also, interestingly, can also be translated as the word God. Because ananda does not mean, oh, I'm so happy because I did get the raise and now I don't have to be insecure and we can have the new car and, you know, the kids are not on drugs and so I feel happy. Ananda means the state of inner awareness that our own natural reality is bliss and that bliss is infinite and unconditioned. And that's where the word translates into the extremely inadequate word God. The word God in English is very difficult because it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything until you define it. I mean, the word bliss at least has some resonance with our reality. We don't have to stretch quite so far to even guess what it means. Whereas the word God, who knows what it means? Many people I meet who are, you know, determined atheists are only atheists because every concept of God they've been given really isn't worthy of their respect, and I respect them for being atheists. But you can start over with a whole nother way of looking at this. Now, in our efforts to escape suffering and our desire to experience bliss, we have to start asking ourselves, are there any universal principles that underlie that experience, or is it just completely random? And this brings us back to where I started with the children. There are profound and deep yogic realities, and when I say yogic realities, I mean the science of yoga is as specific and as detailed as medical science. You know, in medical science, people look at the physical body, and you know, as they were gradually allowed to, they cut the physical body open, they found out how different parts of it work, they conduct certain tests, and they find out what's true. People know that you breathe through the lungs, and people don't really tell you that you breathe through your knees. And it just, people don't tell you that. You have certain pains in your shoulders, and they can analyze, you know, where those pains come from. You have blocked arteries, and it affects your heart in certain ways. People don't argue about these things, except on a peripheral level, but in fundamental ways, these are the facts of the human body, and we know that. Now, the science of yoga is absolutely as exact. It's not people guessing. Now, it is true that a lot of people do guess. A lot of people how would I say it? It would be like someone who's never been to medical school making a lot of declarations about how the physical body works without actually ever really immersing themselves sufficiently into the objective facts of that to be able to make those declarations. Sometimes their guesses may be lucky because you can sort of common sense a certain amount, they might be true up to a certain point. So what we find happening in the realm of spirituality these days is that a lot of people are looking at it from whatever level they're living on and declaring the knowledge that they can perceive. And in many cases, it's not actually wrong. It just may not quite be complete. If someone steeped in what I would really call, in many sense, an orthodox tradition as I am, we begin to understand that the source of knowledge is very important. Like, who said that? Where does it come from? Swami Kriyananda, in his book, this book is his autobiography, and it's the story of how he read Autobiography of a Yogi, how he left everything and went to live with Yogananda, and then what it was like to be with Yogananda. It's a very unusual book. There really is no other book that really talks about Yogananda like this. But this was 1948 when he read Autobiography of a Yogi. I mean, the concept guru, karma, reincarnation, chakras, a lot of words, even the word vibrations. When he met Yogananda, Yogananda said, "How did you like my book, The Autobiography of a Yogi?" And Kriyananda, who was called Donald Walters at that time, because Kriyananda is a name he took later, he was, you know, almost speechless because he just didn't know what to say. He said, "Well, I found it was the most powerful book I've ever read. It completely changed his life," which it did. He read it from front to back. He dropped everything, took a bus across the country. He was living in New York City, found Yogananda, and the first words that came out of his mouth were, "I want to be your disciple." I mean, so it was just all on the basis of reading this book. So when he said this to Yogananda, Yogananda said, "That's because it has my vibrations." All Swamiji could think of was standing on something that was shaking, you know, like this. He never, even just that concept that the subtle vibrations of consciousness can permeate an inanimate object and then a sensitive person can pick up those vibrations, completely unheard of at that time. And so when he was accepted to be a disciple of Yogananda, which he was on the spot, which was very unusual, he just, you know, pulls up from the bus, coming across the country, he finds Yogananda, asked to be his disciple. They had an interview of about half an hour, which is all described in this book, at the end of which Yogananda accepted him, and he was put in a car and taken to the headquarters of Mount Washington and became a monk that day. And, you know, that was it. Swami Kriyananda says he was utterly convinced from his heart, first by the book and then by his meeting with Yogananda, just being there in the presence of Master, as he called him, you know, with those eyes. And at the end of that interview, Kriyananda had Kriyananda, this young boy, kneel in front of him, and then Yogananda put his finger on Kriyananda's heart chakra, heart right here, and he said silently, he just passed power into Swami, as I call him. Swamiji is what I call him, it means teacher. He said Yogananda was sending so much force that his hand was trembling like that. Can you imagine? So he's kneeling in front of this man he's known for 30 minutes, being initiated as a disciple and a monk. Yogananda touches him on the heart, and his hand vibrates with energy. Swamiji said, and he just stood up, and he was a different person. He wasn't hypnotized. He was the person he'd been trying to become, but the guru had picked him up and moved him for it. But Kriyananda said that in those first weeks and months, he was so overwhelmed with what he was learning that sometimes he literally felt dizzy and had to sit down, you know, just at the massiveness of the change. And some of the people in the, ashram there, it was not that well organized, and people had lots of different theories about lots of different things. And all of it sounded completely bizarre to Kriyananda. He didn't know anything. But he would always ask one question.